Hello, Michelle here. There's something I need you to know about. It's called Australian True Crime Plus. For just a couple of dollars a month, you can get extra episodes, including Ask Us Anythings with Emily and I, early access to our weekly episodes, shout-outs, and the complete back catalogue, and all of it ad-free. You can become an Australian True Crime Plus member by hitting the link in the show notes or on our Facebook page.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
The information we've received is a little sketchy, but this is what we can tell you. That the Customs Department has made the biggest ever haul of hashish in Australian history. Now, we understand that 1.9 tonnes, and that's an awful lot of hash, has been found in a camper van, a Mercedes-Benz camper van, which is at present in the possession of the Customs Department at their Marine Centre in Neutral Bay.
There are stories that get under the skin of people, especially journalists. And this story you're going to hear about is unbelievable. And most of us have probably never heard about it. I know I hadn't. Enter author Sandy Logan, a former journalist and diplomat who followed this case of two older American women, Vera Toddy Hayes and Florice Beezy Bessire, who were arrested in Australia in the 1970s for having almost 2 tonnes of hashish concealed in a camper van. That's not personal use amounts, listeners. It's a wild and scandalous story, as you'll discover. But first, Sandy tells us about how we came across this extraordinary case.
I was a journalist for 10 years, and as part of those 10 years, I spent a couple of years on the police desk in Toronto, in my hometown in Canada. And I was on a late shift one night in early 78, and on the late shift, I finished at 1 a.m., and one of the jobs was to check the wires and go over to the telex and pull it up and see if, you know, the Pope been shot or the president's dead or you know, some late break. If there's late breaking news, we had to change page one. So one night early morning, I happened to see a story about two elderly American women arrested in Sydney. This was the end of January 78. And the fact that they had with them 1.9 tons of hashish,
wow,
clearly not for personal use, attracted my interest. And I thought, wow, what a story this must be. And I ripped off the telex, took that, stuffed it in my shirt pocket, and didn't think much more of it until 10 months later, near the end of 78, I returned to Australia, resumed working as a journalist back in Australia. And I thought, geez, I ought to see whatever happened to that story. you know, it's from that the book was born. It's taken a while to get there, but that was the start of that interest in the story and the start of the relationship.
Taken a while to get there. You're not kidding. That's 40 years ago, Sandy.
Yeah. It's 45 from when they first set out, in fact. So yeah, it's a long time ago.
Gosh. So, I mean, we've got to ask, why has this story remained in your mind? There are very few news stories that remain in our imaginations for that long, let alone this one that was originally two lines that you tore off a machine. I can't believe you were still thinking about it 10 months later.
I guess part of there are a number of reasons. One of the reasons was I got so close, and I think we all know this as human beings, that when we get really close to a story, to an issue, to a challenge, to a situation that we become involved in, it can be difficult to detach oneself and look at it objectively and you know, in the cold, stark reality that life is. And I was very close to them, obviously, and very close to this story. So that was one of the first challenges. Second, by the time the women were released from jail, they had been through so much, as you know, as the story goes in the book Betrayed. You know, they survived riots, they survived knife attacks, they survived breakouts and escapes happening around them, drug abuse, the whole slew of experiences inside a prison. And when they finally did get out, there was a sense of, we really need to move on, even though they had looked forward to being able to write this book themselves, to being able to tell their story, because they never felt they got a fair crack. And then the third reason why it was difficult in 83, when they got out of jail, to actually tell this story was there were still some questions around their relationship.
Oh.
Were they or weren't they?
Ah.
And if they were, is this really a story we want to cover? And you know, to me, their relationship, I never queried. I never questioned. It was none of my business. And it didn't matter to me what the basis of the relationship was. This was part of the tabloid media fury.
Because looking at it now in 2020, that had never occurred to me that that was a question. So you're right. We do need to look at it from the lens of, you know, the times that these things happened.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the very beginning, if we may, sir. Starting with, could you please try and explain to us, what does 1.5 tons of hash look like?
It's bigger than an elephant.
No.
So you want to get an idea. If you can smoke an elephant, you're doing pretty good.
I could at uni. I couldn't now.
Exactly. There is an anecdote that I can share with you about what does 2 tons of hash look like? How much does it weigh? How does it affect the performance of a vehicle? That anecdote, and language warning for children, goes to an interview that one of the arresting then Federal Bureau of Narcotics agents conducted with the women. They were arrested separately. And one of the women was asked when a packet of, and there were over 4,000 packets of about a pound each in the vehicle, spread throughout the floor of this 26-foot long, you know, 7-8 meter long camper van. And this packet was put in front of her, as you often see in, you know, in crime shows. Well, here are the drugs. What do you have to say? And Toddy, Vera Hayes, she said to the narc, I don't know what that is. And the narc says, well, that's the hashish that's in your camper van. And Toddy says, I wouldn't have a clue. I don't know what hashish is. I don't know what it looks like. It was still wrapped in a packet. And she said, well, what would you say if I told you there were over 4,000 more of these packets in your camper van? And the way the narc tells the story, the way Mish Curry is her name, the way the narc tells the story is Toddy looked at the packet, looked at her and said, no wonder that motherfucking van wouldn't go up those fucking hills.
Quote,
unquote.
Okay.
So that's what 1.9 tons of hash looks and
Thank
feels
you.
Like.
Yeah, now I'm getting a I'm vibe. Getting and also it answers the question of how on earth were they getting it around. Yeah. I get it.
Sandy, so the women, Toddy and Floris. Is it
Florice Beasy? Yeah, Beasy was her nickname. Yep.
So Vera and Florice, Toddy and Beasy, they are going on, your book says, a trip of a lifetime. They're traveling from Germany to India in a camper van. But how do they end up in Australia?
The title of the book, Betrayed, pretty much gives a sense for what's occurred. And so to get from Germany to what was then Bombay, now Mumbai, they were duped by Toddy, Vera's nephew, to deliver a camper van that he needed allegedly for a production company, a documentary he was making in the Outback. And he had set the seed, he had started grooming them towards this outcome a year before they even left. And when they got to Mumbai, driving this camper van, they're 59 and 61. They're both strong women. They're outdoors people. They love an adventure. They've got their own motorhome in the United States. So it's not like they're unfamiliar with this sort of a lifestyle. But they've never been overseas in their lives before. Mm. This is a mighty big odyssey to set out on. And they get through 9 countries by the time they get to Mumbai, to Bombay. And it's at that point, the arrangement was all expenses paid, trip of a lifetime, overseas holiday like you're never, ever going to imagine. It was basically out of the pages of National Geographic, which they were subscribers to. They get to Mumbai and they're done. They're shot. They're, like, yeah. Toddy is physically a wreck. And the nephew, Vern Todd, the nephew gets an associate to essentially put a gun to their head.
No, figuratively.
Yeah. Figuratively.
No, but they're threatening by that stage. It's no
Oh, they're threatening. Oh. They're holding them to account. You will regret this for the rest of your life. You don't know how big this is. Hang on, what's going on? We were just driving a camper van for your documentary. What do you mean? And he says, you need to go to Melbourne because the carné, which is the customs document that all film companies, people driving cars across borders need to sign, and it's affixed within a passport to this day, might be digital now, but it's a document that essentially says, I have come into this country with this asset. I have not disposed of it, because if you were to sell your car, the state would want taxes for it. So you have to show you've driven the car into the country and you've driven it out. So the carné was in Vera's name. The nephew had very craftily set it up at the start of the trip to get her to take the registration in her name, the carnet in her name, the insurance in her name. And they didn't think twice about it. You know, they were pretty naive. So anyway, he threatened an associate of the nephew, whom they don't know is in fact a drug kingpin, who is moving massive amounts of very fine quality hashish, I'm told, into Australia. He gets one of his associates to threaten them and says, you've got to go to Australia and take delivery. Once you take delivery of the van, you're done. You can go home. Well, of course, that didn't happen. Mm. They fly to Australia. And so the nephew arranges for the shipment of the van while they're flying to Sydney, where ostensibly they're going to take delivery of the vehicle off a ship. He arranges shipment of it from Bombay to Sydney. They remain in situ in Sydney having a lovely little break. And they think after all, well, this is not too bad. They tour the city. They go to the tennis. They rest. They see Yvonne Coley Goolagong.
Oh, wonderful.
Return to playing tennis after having her first child. So, you know, it's quite memorable.
I can tell you now they're gay, by the way, Sandy. Yeah. But anyway, go on. I've heard enough.
They're writing postcards home. They're saying to their friends, look, we're having an unexpected holiday now in Australia. And they're actually really enjoying it because...
Yeah, I can understand the drive because when you think about certainly the last half of the drive, the first half of the drive is through Europe, you know. Driving through Europe for these two American ladies is kind of familiar.
It works.
But then after a certain point, they're going through the Middle East, which is going to be really challenging linguistically and culturally in every way. Then they're driving through Asia, which is like really challenging. And then driving through India today is very, very challenging. And so, and then they get to, you know, Bombay, and they're threatened by some dude. And this has just turned hideous. But then suddenly they're in Sydney and they got nothing to do but relax and recuperate. So you can imagine how they're suddenly going, oh, this isn't so bad. This is okay. We were overreacting.
You've nailed it, Michelle. And on that trip through the second part after Europe.
Yeah.
They're actually in Tehran on the cusp of the revolution.
Of the revolution, of course. So as Americans,
yeah,
you
in
know.
70, in, oh. in 77.
Yeah, that's dangerous.
When the Shah's over to, you know, like they're going through parts of the world that you would never, it was what was known as the hippie trail. Yeah. Let's be honest. Mm. In the 70s, you could take the magic bus out of London across Europe and Asia into the very place they went on their trip. And it was a hippie trail trip. It was a kind of an alternative holiday. But so they hit Sydney. And what they don't realize, because the nephew, this dude is a real sharp operator. What they don't realize is the success that he has had over the years down under, because he's been gone from the family in Los Angeles. The Todd family, Vera's family, came from Los Angeles. The Todd family all understands that he's become a successful entrepreneur. He's an import-export. They didn't know of what. He's running a company selling tubby baths. It's a new innovation. It's basically a blow-up bath for babies that you can easily bathe them in. You know, he's running ads in New Idea, Women's Weekly, or Family Mag, you know, the equivalent in those days. And they think, oh, this is great. You know, nephew Vern has really landed on his feet. But it's when the real Vern shows, it's when he shows his true colors, is in Sydney, and things really start to fall apart. And for Vera, or for Toddy, as we called her, for Vera, it was a real deep hurt, because to her, family and kin was just the best, just so important. She came from a family of five, and her nephew, Vern, he was the first baby in the family. She left war service in Midwest United States during the Second World War to come back to LA to visit her brother who'd had their first child. And she doted on Vern. And to have him turn on her, to betray her like this, and it's gradual. It's not just, I'm threatening you. It's not just, it's bigger than that. It's, oh, no, I'm going to win you back. I love you. I'm sorry. Oh, Auntie Vera this, Auntie Vera that. You know, one of the chapters in the book Betrayed is called Don't Auntie Me, because she finally gets sick and tired. But he's a schmoozer, and he keeps winning them over. They have no idea that customs and narcotics intelligence analysts have been monitoring Vern for quite some time, and they are looking for just this sort of vehicle to come into the country.
And who's going to collect
this,
it?
Yeah, this, they've struck gold with this. They've got no idea how much is in it. But they know his modus operandi. They know he brings in cars, and so they had to flag the sorts of shipments of cargo that they were looking out for. They hit the mother lode with the
camper
van. Oh
God, did they ever? And it's like my worst nightmare. This happening to me. I saw Bangkok Hilton with Nicole Kidman, terrified me. But two older women with a van. It's like the most amazing story. I can tell why you pulled that telex off and was like, wow.
Yeah.
This is, and you basically reported on this the whole way through. You kept your eye on it.
I did. Emily, from the time that I'd returned, I was working as a journalist, as a sub-editor, and I had a bit of spare time. I reached out to them. I wrote a letter to New South Wales Corrective Services Commission. And I said, look, I'm interested in following up two prisoners of yours. Is there any chance that I could visit them? Could you approach them on my behalf? Because I didn't even know what prison they were in.
By the time you got back to Australia, 10 months later or something, wasn't that long, had they been to court yet?
They'd been to court. They'd been sentenced.
Oh,
without,
it was quick.
It was a fairly quick, from the moment of arrest at the end of January to sentencing in April.
Oh, gosh.
It was a fairly brief time. But without spoiling too much for the readers, they did plead guilty. Plead guilty. And that then leads to the further perception, if not the reality, that they were betrayed. Because most people up on a charge of importing 1.9 tons of hashish would probably try to, you know, explain their position with a not guilty plea. Like, especially in their case, the advice they got from their public defender, plead guilty. They had a really good relationship with the narcotics agents who'd busted them. They cooperated, but in the end, they had the book thrown at them. Mm. They had an unprecedented sentence of 14 years jail with nothing on the bottom.
Oh,
no way. No non-parole period. The head sentence was the sentence.
Do you think they would have been in danger from Toddy's nephew if they had said
they were the whole time they're in jail so there's this sense of betrayal clearly by the nephew Vern then a sense of hang on this wasn't the way it was explained to us it would go by the system and the women They were lambs to the slaughter. They'd never been, they'd had six speeding tickets between them in 60 years. So they had no idea about the system. Mm. And so in the end, they had the book thrown at them.
After the break, Sandy tells us about what life was like in prison for these most unlikely inmates.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now here's Sandy to tell us about Toddy and Beezy's life behind bars.
They'd been initially at Mullawa. That's a tough prison. It is now, and it was then in the late 70s. And they could not believe what they were experiencing. They could not believe what prisoners inside, you know, got up to, and the violence and the threats and what have you. And they were pretty tough. They were pretty tough gals. One of them, you know, was in the Women's Army Corps and was recruited to the LAPD. Mm. And the other, that was Toddy, and the other woman, Beezy, Fleurice, she worked on assembly lines for many years. She was as tough as they come when she needed to be. There's a great story in there about how they stood up to a gang inside one of the prisons. So when I tracked them down, they had by then been moved. This was now. So I returned late 78. By 79, I've tracked them down. I go and visit them, and they're now up at a new, it's almost like a prison farm in a small community called Tomago. Big smelter up there, up on the, you know, near Newcastle. Mm-hmm. And it's a farm out in the middle of nowhere. And it's just beautiful. You don't see any buildings. You see the bush. You see, in fact, they didn't even lock the front gate. It was covered with mesh, not razor wire, nothing like that. These were all trusted prisoners. And they said, you know, it was probably really good for their mental health, mm-hmm, to be in a prison like that, because it wasn't like being in prison, but it was. And let me give you an example of the sorts of liberties that they lost, that they really noticed, and I very quickly became attuned to, because I hadn't had anything to do with prisoners. I hadn't been inside a prison before, so it was new to me. When I arrived, I used to visit them every weekend. Once I made contact, once we developed some trust, I'd visit them every weekend. I'd find a way in between my other commitments to get up to Tomago, and then when they returned to Sydney, to the Sydney prison, to visit them there. So I got up to Tomago, sat down in the mess, and as you would expect, the finest instant coffee, International Roast, was there on the side with an urn of boiling water and a bit of coffee, yep, and a bit of milk. And I said to the women, can I go and get you a coffee? And they both said, sure. You know, nothing like having someone serve on you in prison. So they both wanted milk and sugar. So I got their two mugs, you know, and I carried their two mugs plus mine back to the table and sat down. And because I was carrying three mugs, I hadn't filled them right up. I didn't want to be spilling. And I put them down in front of them. And Toddy looked up at me and she said, I asked for a full cup of coffee. Oh. So I went back, filled it right up, and brought it back to her. And what that was her asserting some power, asserting her ability to tell me that this was what she wanted. Because you can't, as a prisoner, you don't have that right to tell, you know, if you do, you do it at the risk of getting a beating or a flogging or being, you know, being put into to isolate or whatever. And this was a very, very small thing. But I learned from that that this is how disempowered they had become. That being able to tell me I want a full cup of coffee and I expect you to go back and get it for me was a kind of a win for them. I let them have that win every time and any time they wanted.
How were Toddy and Beezy going in terms of their mental health? Because they'd been through such an incredible trauma and it was all so unfair and they had such a long stretch to go and no one was helping them.
In fairness, they had three kind of support groups working for them. They had their lawyer or lawyers in the end. They had a Christian cohort because, as you can expect, their faith was probably the only thing that was a constant and they really cleaved to that. So there was a Christian network of really supportive people. And then there was me. There was this outlier, you know, journo guy that was trying to push every button and turn every knob and tap, knock on every door I could think of. But how were they going? You know, number one, the betrayal by Toddy's nephew just tore her apart. And she said a number of times that it was so sickening, it was so hurtful that she had this hate for him that she had to find a way to expunge it, to get rid of it, because it was tearing her apart. She couldn't live with such hatred.
And what was the rest of the family doing, by the way? Like, how did everyone else sit? Because that's happened. So her best friend, Beezy, is in this situation because of her nephew and because of her love and trust in her nephew. And, you know, what about his parents? What are they doing and saying about it?
This is the second part about how were they going in prison.
Yeah.
Toddy's two sisters were just wonderful. They regularly wrote. They would try and phone occasionally. They did lots of cassette tape letters in those days. Whereas her two brothers, one of whom was the father of the nephew who betrayed them, they basically had nothing to do with the women. One of them had the gall to say, well, that'll teach you.
No.
Not in as many words, but that was essentially his attitude. And the brother who was the father, who was also the brother was named Vernon. Toddy felt so bad about what her brother's son had done that she couldn't bring herself to confront him in a letter. She wrote to him a couple of times and he wrote a couple of times. But the pain that it caused her, she didn't want to inflict on others by saying, look at what your son has done to me and to my friend. It tore her apart so much. So the family, on one hand, the two sisters were just wonderful. They were there right to the end. They were there to welcome her home and Beezy home when they finally got out. But the brothers, I went over a couple of times knocking on doors around Washington, D.C. and other places to try and get some political support in the U.S. And on those two occasions that I was abroad and including visits to the United States, neither of the brothers would see me. Whereas both of the sisters would. So they didn't have the family support while they were in jail. So how did they go? They struggled because they didn't have that. But the most important thing in this space is that Beezy, who all along, right from the outset, when this proposition was put to them, I got a camper van, it's custom made, you're going to love it, can you deliver it? She said, I don't know, like you don't get something for nothing. What's going? She always had a little sense, but she was faithful to Toddy. She said, you know your family, you know your nephew. Beezy was the rock that kept Toddy sane, sometimes got her down off the cliff, got her down off the edge, and supported her all the way through. And for example, the superintendent who was in charge of the final prison, the acting superintendent, still alive today, and I've spoken to her in writing the book. She says, unquestionably, if it were not for Beezy, Toddy would not have lasted her period of incarceration.
Really? So Beezy never turn? And in the sense of, oh, Toddy, I knew this was a bad idea. If it wasn't for you and your terrible nephew and your dumb family.
They a couple of times had sharp words on the road as they were in Bombay, and then when they were in Melbourne, there was just something not right. There's just something. But in regardless of whether it was Beezy who had that sense of something just not right here, or we're really in deep, I would suggest by the time they hit Australia, it was like they were in quicksand, but they were only on the edge of the quicksand. And each step, the classic, each step they took, the deeper in from which they could no longer extricate themselves. Oh, and there were listening devices in the van. There were tracking devices. There were helicopters in the... I mean, this was a brilliant operation. It was called Operation Genius.
Wow.
Because this was going to be, as I suggested earlier, the mother lode, if they could get to it. Because they were expecting, get this, they were expecting to pull out, because they'd done drill samples under the van on board the ship before it was offloaded. And they each drill bit they pulled out, ooh, the entire length of the floor of the van. They thought there must be 60 or 80 kilograms in this camper van. So it was the mother load. So I don't think, you know, Beezy wanted to end it. And at one point, Toddy said, well, you go home then.
Oh.
You and Beezy said, no, I'm not leaving you. I'm not leaving you alone. Like, you know, she was very faithful in that regard, very supportive. And Toddy's health wasn't 100% even when they started off. There was a beginning signs of a cataract. She'd had sciatic nerve issues. She'd had lumbar surgery, she had a fall on the job. And that's why she'd retired early, pensioned out, you know. And here she is stuck in a car. She did all the van driving. She was the driver. Beezy did the navigating. And by the time they got to Mumbai, it was not good. And her blood pressure were, you know, so there are all sorts of health issues that you get when you get older, but exacerbated by the pressure they were under. And then when they got to Australia, they just got themselves mired in deep.
What can you tell us about that post-prison time in their lives when they, I guess, both went back to the States, and what was waiting for them there?
So by the time they did get out of jail, and they didn't do the whole time, but they did significant period of jail time and got back to the United States. Times had changed. Society had moved on. Lapine, the small community from which they came, was no longer a small community. It had doubled, almost tripled in size. And I realized I flew back to join them, to help them resettle, drive a U-Haul van from where their goods were stored, settled them into their home, took them to get Toddy needed to get her driver's license, that sort of thing. I realized that as much as they valued all that had been done for them, as much as they valued their freedom now, in order for them to move on, we needed to cut the umbilical cord. I reminded them of Australia. I reminded them of their prison time. I reminded them of their struggle. I reminded them of the betrayal that they'd been through on so many levels. And in a way, I understood that because I too had to move on in my life. And I'd recently married. In fact, I'd put off my wedding date, you know, because this was taking. So I also had to move on. So we reluctantly agreed that they were going to write a book. They were going to tell their story. And they said, no, we just here. And they handed me their diaries, they handed me their audio cassette tapes, they handed me their photos, cards, letters. They said, we don't want to be reminded of this any longer here. So that was one big step for them once they got out of jail, you know, in terms of adapting and realizing that what they'd hoped for, what their expectations were not going to quite come to fruition. And the other part was that their relationship remained strong, but some of the townsfolk never quite accepted them again.
Yeah.
Some of the locals weren't quite sure about them, and their relationship and the basis for it then became a bit of tongue-wagging fare in the community. And sadly, they didn't stick around Lapine much longer.
What you're saying, it sort of circles back to where we started, which is, because I was sort of thinking without the internet being in existence in those days, and the other interesting thing is having tried to Google these women. There is nothing online about these women at all. So your book is really the only place we can read the story or see any of these photos or any of this. It's amazing what you've got. I was naively thinking maybe no one in their hometown would know what had happened to them because it was so far away from Australia, from where they went to jail, from where it all happened, really, from the end of the story. So are you saying that everyone in their hometown knew that they had gone to jail in Australia for a drug crime? And also, was that when they started to suspect maybe that they were gay as well, and all that their sexuality had become an issue during that time as well?
So kind of and not quite. So
right.
When they were busted, when they were arrested and it made the news, they put Lapine on the map.
Oh.
And reporters flocked to Lapine like there was no tomorrow. Right. So it was all over the shop. There were stories from all the neighbors, the friends. No one in Lapine could believe it. No one could believe it. And they all said that. And I've got all the clippings from that time, from the local papers, from Australian papers, you know, even the Mirror and the Sun, the two tabloids, the two afternoon tabs in Sydney, they both sent reporters over to interview the locals. So it was a big yarn, a big story. So there was plenty of coverage at the time. When they returned, and I've since spoken to a couple of old timers in Lapine who knew the women. One of them was an employer of Beezy. Beezy hated being unoccupied. So she worked at the local hardware store, assembling the power tools, the lawn mowing tools, the hedgers. And the other one ran the laundromat, because a lot of the homes in Lapine in the 70s, this is a small community to which the two women had more or less retired. And it was a, you know, small lumberjack community, but great fishing, great hiking. A lot of these people lived in what were mobile homes situated on a 1 acre block. It wasn't a trailer park. It wasn't a mobile home park. They were just mobile homes, and not all of the mobile homes had a laundry. So the laundromat was a popular hangout.
Yeah.
So I spoke to these two women to ask them, you know, what do you remember about the gals, and what can you tell me? And they both remembered them fondly, but they both remembered them as being gay. And one of them said, I didn't pick it, but my sister, she knew right away, but I didn't. It didn't matter to me. And the other one said, there was a bit of talk in town, but she never tried anything on me. And it was just these classic American conservative, but genuine, you know, heartfelt impressions. And even just because they said they knew what the basis of the relationship was, still doesn't, you know, it doesn't confirm anything to me that was the perception, that was the belief. And again, I don't care. Doesn't matter. Didn't matter to me then, doesn't matter to me now.
I hate to ask this question, but when did they pass away, and what were the end of their days like?
Well, Toddy only lived a couple of years after freedom.
Oh. Okay.
She and Beezy was by her side.
Yeah, of course.
Beezy lived well into her 80s. She relocated back up to the west coast of Washington State. Like they'd moved out of Lapine not long after they got back, when it wasn't the place they remembered. And there were other reasons, which I go into in the book, why they left, why it was advantageous for them to get out of the wet and the cold. Mm. But once Toddy had passed, Beezy relocated back up to Washington State on the west coast, where her sister and brother-in-law lived. Mm. And that's where she lived her final days.
Aww.
and she passed in the mid 90s. So she at least did have some years of good health. And I in fact saw her. Well, the whole family did. The kids met her, and you know, they now, all these years later, saying, "Oh, that's who that was."
Sandy, how did you move from your role? You're a journalist. You're obviously intrigued by this story, but you become an advocate, and you know, you've written this book. It's 45 years since it happened, and you seem like the best person to tell this story. So, how did you navigate that change from being a journalist, where you've got this bloody awesome story, but also you're genuinely wanting to help these women? Like, how did you manage those roles?
Yeah, this is a tough one for me, because this period, the context, you know, late 70s, early 80s, this was a time when getting onto a good yarn was uppermost in terms of your editor or your producer. By this time, I was a producer and researcher at Four Corners, and then I'd moved to producing morning radio with the ABC with Caroline Jones and then Margaret Throsby. So I was working heavy duty news every day, but having access to the women, as it were, and then determining just how big a challenge this was going to be, didn't pose to me a conflict, and it certainly didn't seem to pose, you know, to my bosses that there was a conflict, but clearly there was. When I reflect now, it was clearly a conflict. How can you be a journalist while at the same time you're campaigning? And I must say, I always declared that. There was never a sense that, oh, I just happened to come across this story and, you know, I've done it today and, okay, wash my hands, move on to the next story the next day. You know, it was well known among media circles at the time that I was associated quite closely with the women, and certainly among politicians. And even then, you know, there were times I probably overstepped the mark and I might have approached a minister or a diplomat or someone on the pretext of wanting to interview them for a story, without also saying, because they may not have realized, oh, and by the way. So I don't think you would stand for it today. And I can understand that because the ethics...
I think you were just pioneering magazine-style journalism, really.
I think you did an amazing job.
Yeah, I think you were just a pioneer of a different style of journalism, don't you?
Well... I'm still troubled by it. I wasn't troubled by it then, but I'm troubled by it now. And this is a question I've often thought that, you know, was this right? There was no deception. I wasn't betraying anyone. But I think that if you're going to be a journalist and you're going to maintain that objectivity and that detachment from becoming the story, then you have to do that. But if you want to become part of the story as an activist, as a campaigner, as someone who, then you need to declare that up front each and every time you're reporting. And B, you have to be really careful about the mark over which you might step. And and look, it's happened. The result was fantastic for the women. Yeah. I wouldn't have done it any differently, let's say that. Look, even though I said that one of the things that they needed was to cut the umbilical cord, you know, the figurative umbilical cord with me once they got their freedom, we still kept in touch. We still wrote. We did Christmas cards. We'd occasionally be in touch. And even with Toddie's two sisters, we kept in touch. And then when Beezy passed all those years later, we kept in touch with her family, her relatives. And to this day, I'm still in touch with many members of Beezy's offspring, like her sisters, her sisters and brothers' offspring, and Toddie's. Less so with Toddie's, because the one mystery out of the book that your listeners will ponder over is Vern Todd, the nephew, was married in Australia and had two sons. He fled Australia and abandoned them. Whatever happened to them?
How old would they be?
Kids are in their 40s, maybe even 50s now, early 50s. And the wife, whom he, I think, eventually divorced, none of them will speak to me. And I don't want to visit the sins of the father on the two sons. It's not their fault. It's got nothing. They're not responsible. And if his ex-wife doesn't want to talk about the time when this all occurred and she was present. Mm. Again, I don't want to visit the sins of her ex-husband on her, but they're all still alive. They're all, I think, aware that the book is coming out because I approached Vern's ex-wife back in the 80s, in 83, 84, when I first had a crack at this manuscript. And then I approached her again when I had another crack at it. And through an intermediary this time, the second time, and she didn't want to talk. She didn't want to talk at all. So I respect that, and I understand why. But that's a bit of a mystery.
You include some interesting little tidbits about Vern, and it's there's lots of great reasons for you to read this book because we have not scratched the surface. So thank you so much, Sandy.
Thank you, Sandy.
It's really a powerhouse, this book, yeah, of research and...
And perseverance. It's, yes, like the story of a lifetime. This is what every journalist dreams of.
And dedication to these two beautiful ladies. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Look, we learned something. We learned about other people. There's beautiful people in prison, and I don't care what anybody says. I've seen beautiful people in prison. Some of them I prefer to a lot of people on the outside that think they're just so sanctimonious. We've seen beautiful women. No way am I ever... I'm not sorry. I learned something.
Thanks to our guest, Sandy Logan. His book, Betrayed, is published by Hachette. Grab a copy. It's an extraordinary read.
And thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime, recorded at a Hub Australia media studio, hubaustralia.com. Find the workspace that's right for you.
This has been another Smartfella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.